give me a child until he is seven, and I will show you the man. That idea goes all the way back to Aristotle. And there's no doubt the ancient philosopher was onto something about how your childhood shapes you as an adult. But now science has taken this traditional wisdom a step further. And above all else is one simple, surprising factor pointing to what kind of life you'll lead. It's self-control. Children with good self-control have better life outcomes. This is one of the findings of a world-renowned longitudinal study of 1,000 New Zealanders. Dr. Sandhya Ramraka is research manager for this study and joins us on Skype from Dunedin. And Sandhya, just to start with, can you tell me a little bit about the Dunedin study? It began back in 1972. Why was it first established?
So, yes, that's an interesting question. You know, how come a study from a sort of sleepy old little town like Dunedin is making waves? The study was first established by Dr. Phil Silver, and basically he wanted to see how kids with problems were faring, born with problems, were faring compared to kids without any problems, and decided to follow them up at age three and then again at age five. It was actually meant to stop there, but we're currently assessing them again at age 45.
Right. So it certainly has kept going. Now, this has become a world-renowned study. What is so special about it?
Well, what's special about it is it's what you call in science a general population sample. What it means is that you've got everyone from all walks of life. It's everyone born in Dunedin in that 1 year period. And that's important because you're capturing all kinds of people. You're capturing the well-off people, you're capturing people with problems. So it is a complete general population sample. That's one thing that makes it important. The other two main factors that make it important is that these babies have now been followed to, as I said, age 45, that is currently happening, and information on them have been collected on regular basis. So we're not looking back and asking questions where there could be faulty memory. So we've collected a lot of information on everyone. There's the depth of information. They come into a research unit here, and there's all kinds of machines and various interviewers. So we collect the information that way. And there's a breadth of information. It's a multidisciplinary study. It's one of those big words that twists your tongue, but and unfortunately that's the name of the study as well. But it looks at not only mental health, it looks at physical health, it looks at social situations. So there's quite a breadth of information that's been collected, and that allows us to do things that other studies aren't able to do.
Well, the study has attracted attention with some of its recent findings that link evaluations of brain and mental function of three-year-olds with all sorts of adult outcomes, you know, from whether they're likely to become obese to getting caught up in crime. Tell us about those findings.
Yeah, so that's a perfect example of using all this information that that I described. So what the researchers here tested was something called this Pareto principle that comes from an Italian philosopher, I think. Anyway, what it says is that 20% of the people account for 80% of problems. And so in this study, we were able to look at what we called economic burden. So we looked at a number of things like criminal convictions, so things that cost the government and society money. Criminal convictions being on welfare benefits, you know, filling of prescriptions, and of course obesity, which then results in lots of health problems. And what we found in the study was that 20% of the study members actually accounted, as the principal said, 80% of the burden in all of this. It was a small group that fed into this massive burden. In New Zealand, there's a saying, it's like seven Datsuns in the driveway. And it's basically about the same family getting all the services from government and various agencies. And that's what this describes. So the study was the first to show that, but probably a lot of workers in various fields knew that intuitively because they see it happen all the time.
So how did you do the evaluation with the three-year-olds? I mean, what sort of things were you looking at that age that then gave you this information?
Yeah, so having done that study, you think, okay, that's great as an exercise, but how do we then work with improving the lives of people? What can we do? And so what happened there was then we looked at a measure that we had at age three. So the first follow-up of the study members were at age three. And we looked at what we called what we termed as brain function. So basically, it was like a 45-minute or so evaluation of these three-year-olds then, and basically it was things like your ability to express language, to understand language, and to do fine motor skills, you know, those colouring with crayons and cutting with scissors, you know, at preschool, being able to paint, working with Lego, those sorts of things. But also things like self-control. So we looked at all of those things, and we found that if you looked at this group, they formed study members poor in this group, they formed the bulk of the 80%. So we could predict quite accurately how that this group would fall into that 80% burden group. And self-control was one of these factors.
Yes, so now that's a really interesting one, the self-control. What has the study found in relation to a young child's capacity for self-control, and what kind of adult they're likely to grow into?
Yeah, so we did a separate study from this earlier one that I'm talking about, and that's why we are now also using self-control to look at other things. And that study came about because there's a Head Start program in the US which was aimed to improve IQ in children, and it didn't really succeed in improving IQ. But when these kids were followed up, they found that there were improvements in other areas of life, like there were less sort of unplanned teenage pregnancy, more of them stayed at school and things like that. And so they wondered, actually it was James Heckman, who's a Nobel Prize-winning economist, wondered whether this might have to do with self-control, that they learned some skills in the lessons they had to improve IQ that were really about self-control and not IQ.
So when you talk about self-control, what do you mean by that exactly?
Right, so what's self-control? Psychologists also use that term, emotional regulation. So basically, if you break it down, you're looking at different areas like being able to think before you sleep and speak and act. So not giving in to a very visceral reaction. Resisting temptation. So not having another biscuit or piece of cake, or not being impulsive. So having more of a considered response. Not being inappropriate and hurtful, resisting that tick for tat. So in children, if you look at children, it's like, you know, the impulsive kid that acts without thinking, or they can't wait for his or her turn, they want to do it now, they get frustrated very easily and want to give up. They dislike doing things that might take effort, so they want it to all happen easily and quickly. Very poor attention span. Not being able to persist with the task and forgetting what they started to do. So these are the characteristics of someone with very low self-control.
This is Life Matters with Amanda Smith, along with Dr. Sandhya Ramraka, who's research manager for the Dunedin Longitudinal Study that's been running since 1972 with 1,000 New Zealanders who are now 45 years old. And I got to say, there are some areas of self-control that I don't think I've had. Never really been able to delay gratification around chocolate, for example. I wonder, were you good at self-control and delayed gratification as a child? Can you see any ripple effects of that in your adult life? You can let us know on Facebook. Now, you might remember that there was a famous study done about 50 years ago. It's often referred to as the Stanford Marshmallow Experiment. It's where children were given a marshmallow, one marshmallow, and told they're allowed to eat it, but they're also told that if they waited a short period and didn't eat it, they'd get two marshmallows. It was essentially a test of the kids' ability to practice delayed gratification. And it found that those who were able to hold off for that second marshmallow did better later in life. So Sandhya Ramraka, does the Dunedin study, your findings, essentially come to that same conclusion?
Yes, it certainly does. But it, I guess the difference is that one, that we looked at a wide range of different things in adulthood as well. And as I mentioned earlier, the one of the reasons the study is so famous is it is a general population sample. So it's not just a selected group of little kids. In this experiment, for example, it's everyone from all walks of life. And because they've been measured as they've gone along, we've got things that we can rule out. So when we found links between low self-control and poor outcomes in adulthood, then it poses the questions, is it because could socioeconomic status, for example, explain this? And we were able to look at that and say, no. Could IQ explain this? If you had low IQ, that might have a factor in it. And we were able to look at and say that that didn't take away the relationship between poor self-control and poor outcomes in life. So those are things like that that we were able to do in this study that makes it a very comprehensive study.
Do you have any sense of why a little child does or doesn't have self-control?
It could be due to a number of things. It could be the parenting skills, for example. It could just be characteristics that they are born with. It, you know, could be due to a number of things. But the beauty of this finding, the heartening thing about it is self-control is a skill. So it's not something you're born with. You can be trained to improve
good because,
your self-control.
You know, I was thinking, as you've been talking, I was thinking this is a bit depressing for some of us. You know, as I said, I wasn't that great at delaying gratification as a kid. I was the one who'd always eaten my Easter eggs by Sunday night. So I'm wondering if people like me are doomed to poor life outcomes, and should parents who think their child isn't so great at self-control be worried? I think you're giving us a little bit of hope there about it being a learned skill.
Absolutely, and a lot of hope. And so, you know, in eating your Easter eggs by Sunday, that's, you know, I'd say most of us have probably done that. And we're looking at a wide range of things, you know. So we're looking at the kid that, as I was describing, the poor self-control child, that isn't able to basically regulate their emotions in a wide range of areas, and that the whole package makes it someone with poor self-control. What the beauty of what we found was that we basically had five categories of self-control. So we went from low self-control to a little bit higher and so forth to the highest levels of self-control. And when we looked at the outcomes in life, like health and wealth, drug use, for example, what we found was that even if you moved from the very low group to the second lowest group, things improved in adulthood. And so a number of us researchers give this talk to various people, various groups here in New Zealand and overseas. And what I find when I give this talk to early childhood teachers, for example, and primary school principals, is that it validates that the work they do. Really, if you think about it, in the early childhood centres, self-control is taught all the time, you know, Johnny, wait your turn kind of thing, or let so-and-so go first and then you do that. So all of those things are instilling self-control in children.
Yes, but if self-control is taught all the time, then why are we seeing it come through in this study?
Well, perhaps it's not taught as comprehensively, and perhaps we can do, and that's what a lot of research that has stemmed from this study, not by us but other groups, are looking at ways to improve that even further. And the good thing is you don't have to target just the low self-control group, because everyone can benefit from increasing their self-control. You know, I can benefit from thinking it's too cold and not exercising tonight to actually doing some exercise. So we can all benefit from increasing our self-control. And so a number of people are looking at ways to make teaching of self-control more effective in early childhood centres and places like that. And for parents to, you know, instill that skill in their children.
So what your results really do is, you know, offer some insights, I suppose, into when and how to intervene with children who might not be great at self-control?
Yes, yeah. And basically saying, if you keep teaching children ways to either delay gratification, to wait their turn for something, to just sit with a task for, you know, for 5 minutes, if they're the child that can't sit with a task for 1 minute, all of that will make a difference later in life. So it doesn't matter that if this one child isn't able to sit for very long and others are sitting doing something for 20 minutes, you don't have to take that child from 1 minute to 20 minutes. If you take that child from 1 minute to 5 minutes of concentration, that's an improvement.
Mm.
And it can be taught throughout. The best window of opportunity is very early in the life course. So, you know, kids in preschool. We're very malleable then. And so that's the best window of opportunity. But then if you miss that, it doesn't matter. When you go to school, you can carry on. Teachers can carry on with that sort of training. And as I said, even as adults, we could certainly improve our self-control and it'll improve outcomes for us.
Well, now, as we've been talking about, the participants in this longitudinal Dunedin study are now 45 years old. What are you doing now in the study? There's a new phase. Is about to begin, I think.
Yes, well, it has begun and we've been very busy. We've had almost 2 months of data collection and our study members have been coming in several a day. What the study is at age 45 is now focusing on aging because we're all going to be living longer. And one of the things with aging research is that a lot of aging research concentrate on old people, as you would imagine it would. But really, then you've missed out on early markers of aging. And because the study has all this information from birth, now at age 45, this current assessment is looking at a lot of baseline markers of aging. And then future work, we hope, will show us why some people age badly and other people age really well. What we did do recently, a couple of years ago, was to show that even though chronologically, all our study members were at that stage 38 years old, biologically, so we looked at a number of biomarkers, biologically they ranged from 29, I think it was, to 62. So we know already that some of them are very healthy and aging extremely well, and others are aging very badly with lots of health problems. And what we hope to show in the future is why that's happening.
This really is like a gigantic scientific 7-up, I guess, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. Yes, it has been described like that, yes.
Dr. Sandhya Ramraka is the research manager for the Dunedin Multidisciplinary Health and Development Study that's been running since 1972 with 1,000 New Zealanders. An amazing resource of information. Sandhya, a pleasure to have you join us here in Life Matters. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And it's Amanda Smith with you. And with that matter of self-control as a little one coming through to when you're older, let us know if that rings true for you. Did you have self-control when you were little or not? Has that come through into your adult life, do you think? You can comment on Facebook, and you're listening to Life Matters.